This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 187. We're going to edit out all this Klingon stuff, right? I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Larry Nemechek. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a restoration project for the original Enterprise filming model, an update on Portal 47, and we look back at Robert Wise's impact on Star Trek. Then in the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt and Mike Sussman to discuss Voyager's seventh season. So let's step into the Ready Room. Well, Larry, it's great to have you back in the Ready Room with me. I'm glad you made it here. I was really concerned. I'm glad to see that you survived what you were doing earlier tonight, the premiere of Red Shirt Diaries Season 2.
Yes, survived. Well, I ran into a little bit, a bad patch of bowl traffic, Hollywood bowl traffic. But coming home was smooth sailing and, yeah, and you know me, I preferred to take the shuttle rather than the transporter.
Exactly. I mean, you're always in your Bones character. Always.
Well, since you prompted me that, and I probably stole your line, then maybe, absolutely, yeah.
But what was it like? So this was Ashley and Jason. They actually, at the theater, they premiered season two of Red Shirt Diaries. And
yeah, we were talking, and I actually taped a little thing afterwards for Trekland. So hopefully if I can put it up before five years get by, because the new shows start September 13th once a week. And this was just a little event in an hour. There's a theater slash bar called the IO Club, and small groups, improv groups, they teach in there. They have shows at night, and they apparently knew somebody that knew somebody, and one of the guest stars, I think, was in the improv group after them tonight, and was able to get it for a very, very reasonable price, as in for free, ahead of prime time. So, they previewed, I don't know, six or eight, whatever he's got done so far. They previewed about the first six episodes, and it was a lot of fun. Cool. Yeah, I got there a little late. They got a little late start, but they showed that, and then by the time they got through everything and talked just very briefly, it was time to clear the theater and have the next thing come in. But people hung out and watched the next improv group, which was really funny. And the guy in their cast, the guest star, who's been in some of the previews, who's the psychologist-looking blonde-headed guy with the glasses, and I'm sorry, I don't know his name, but he was in the improv group after that. And one of the improv things, he forced, you know, improv, you go with the group, and he took his turn, his segment of the evening, he forced the rest of the group to do a Star Trek kind of improv theme in honor of the Red Shirt Diaries premiere party. It was like right before. And we're talking like, you know, 40 people, 50 people. It's a very small theater. What's funny is I think he was partial to Ashley because she was like yelling loud, but it wound up being, he's like, okay, give me a Star Trek. And she's like, Deep Space Nine. He's like, okay, and give me a place in Star Trek. And I swear to God.
Oh, so it's like, whose line is it anyway?
It is. Oh, it's improv. It, you know, it's like getting stuff from the audience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And about the time, probably three-fourths of the audience and the rest of his troop are all going, what? What does he say? What? Because we're about six or eight people held over from the thing. he says that. She says D6-9. I just start laughing. I'm like, okay, well, of all the things to like throw at an improv group to spring off from, you're like, that's kind of obscure. And then he says, give me a location from DS9. And I swear to God, she says, Impoc Nor. And I'm like, what?
That sounds like Ashley.
And so they proceeded to have characters who were all like the DS9 characters, but were, you know, there was a Quark and an Odo. And he was kidding. He was like, and then thank you, because all of my fellow troop members who, my fellow robot, whatever they were called, none of whom have any clue what we're talking about. When they said Worf the first time, the guy thought he said woof and thought it was a dog and was, you know, anyway. So, yeah, that's it funny. Was very easy to survive that. A lot of fun. And they're great.
Well, that sounds cool.
And we got a little chat. So we'll have a chat up on Trekland very soon.
Okay. So that's going to be up on your site on Trekland. Uh-huh. And you can go to the redshirtdiaries.com and check out what they're doing.
They have 20 episodes they're going to start unrolling. Yes. And I'm...
Yeah, it's awesome.
They spilled the beans. I saw myself for the first time tonight.
Oh, did they? Okay. Yeah. That's been under wraps, I know. So, okay. Yeah, so Larry will be appearing in an episode.
Well, that's the fact that I've been one of the guest stars. It's the next to last, so you have to get all the way through the season, or their season. Yeah.
All right. Well, go check it out. And also, on Continuing Mission, I've had Ashley and Jason on a couple of times to talk about this and planning to have them on again soon as well. So go check it out, theredshirtdiaries.com. All right. Well, before we get into news things that we're going to talk about today, and then after news, we're going to be joined by Charlene Schmidt and also Mike Sussman to talk about Voyager Season 7.
Can't wait.
I do have a few things I want to tell everyone about. The first is, if you're listening to this show and you're not familiar with the rest of the network, this is just one of many, many shows that we have here on Trek FM. We have a dedicated show for every single Star Trek series. We also have shows about science and creative beyond Star Trek and books and comics and even non-Trek geek things. And you can find it all if you're an Apple user by going to iTunes.com/TrekFM. That will take you right to our artist section in the store. We are a featured provider for Apple in iTunes, and we really thank Apple for giving us that section. And if you're not an Apple user, you can find us in many other places. You can go to our website and stream or get the RSS feed. You can also find us in Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker. We're on SoundCloud. We're all over the place. Just search for Trek.fm and you'll find us there. And I hope you could check out all of our other shows. I'd also like to thank our associate producers here on The Ready Room, Renee Roberts and Zachary Frueling. They help us get the show out to you guys every week. They support the network through Patreon, and we are a listener-supported network. So without the help of Renee and Zachary and all of our other great patrons, we wouldn't be able to bring the shows to you. So please go to patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the family here and help keep Star Trek Talk going day after day and week after week. And again, you can find Renee on Twitter. Mares_1701 is her name. And Zachary is on Twitter at Zachary Frueling. And Frueling is Fruhling. And we really thank them and everyone for supporting the network. So, Larry, we've got a couple of news items to talk about today. And none of them have anything to do with Star Trek Beyond. For the first time in a couple of shows.
I was a couple of months ago talking about how this is the quietest, least, you know, bubbly, you know, whatever, bopping on the radar Star Trek movie shoot. But
this film.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen it bubbling up a little bit more lately and more stuff getting, you know, people Instagramming and the guys.
A little bit. You know, yeah. Photos are leaking.
Yeah,
out
yeah. And some of the bloopers yeah. of the Omaze campaign were out. So there's some actual stuff starting to leak out. And I said, I'm wackily. It's just because this is the one that has the absolute lowest expectation of the lowest. That's why I'm quasi, quietly, silently, cautiously optimistic that the bar is so low we might actually be a little entertained.
Maybe so. Well, we'll find out. But what we're going to talk about right now has nothing to do with that. We're going to talk about the original shooting model of the Enterprise 1701 that was used on the series itself. And conservators at the Emil Bueller Conservation Laboratory are working on restoring the model. This is the 11-foot studio model that was used in all 79 episodes of the series. And they're trying to restore it to the final configuration, which was completed in August of 1967 at the end of the filming of The Trouble with Tribbles. They made some modifications, you know, over the years to that. Now, Larry, I've never actually seen this model in person, but maybe you have?
I have. My older brother, so this went to the Smithsonian in 75,
That's
76,
right. Yeah.
Along with the Klingon D7, one of the Klingon D7 models, and the Tholian ship, a couple other little pieces. But my older brother saw it before me and took some pictures in the 70s and 80s. They had it. They would always display it in the context of, no, this was not. And we're talking about the Air and Space Museum, where the Spirit of St. Louis and the, you know, the space capsules and the Wright brothers plane, where those are. And of course, the Enterprise is a fictional craft, but they would put it in the context and in galleries where, you know, the fictional craft that inspired us to really go into the atmosphere and go into flight and go into space. And that's just important sometimes in a synergy of, you know, creativity and inspiration. And of course, we always talk about the NASA Star Trek love affair, and it's very much a thing. And that's the way it was displayed for a long time, and it was hung from the ceiling, kind of, you know, different galleries, but generally that was it. He sent me some pictures. I did get to see it in 1986. We were actually – I was in high school. God, I'm dating myself again here. I was on a trip to New York and Washington. And one of the highlights I wanted to do was go by the Air and Space Museum, and I was pissed because it wasn't on display yet. So I missed it there, but, you know, when you're a kid, you don't ever think about there being a tomorrow. But yes, within 10 years, I got to see it hung, and I took a ton, and it was on a bi-level area where you could go to the second floor, and it was hanging kind of in a through deck kind of arrangement. So you could actually get up closer to it when you went upstairs and went to that balcony. And it hung in between, you know, corridors and floorways on either side then. And it was suspended from the top. And yes, I stood there for an hour just imagining. And I was shooting Kodachrome slides. So, you know, it was pretty good photography. And shooting every angle I could think of and all the things you never saw. And the patched up side, you know, where the cables came out in TV, they had not tried to do a lot. Doug Drexler, actually, the days of the giant poster book. The Star Trek giant poster book did an excellent photo session and an article for the Times of what it looked like then. And, you know, that was like 76, 77, 78. But yeah, I saw it in 86. Apparently it had been through a restoration or two by then, but it was still pretty close to the original look. And I'm just thrilled that I was there when it was hung like that, where it seemed more majestic and it was not encased by anything. And it was in a place where you could get, like I said, you could get on different levels and get close, get far away, and do whatever you wanted to do. I love those slides, and I've used them in the communicator a few times.
That's cool. You know, it sounds like your brother may be the person that these guys are looking for, because it says that they're looking for firsthand primary source photos or film of the ship's early years. And especially photos of it being on public display between 1964 and 1976. So your brother's photos that he sent you, I think should fall to the tail end of that time period, right?
Right. Well, when this new story came out, because people, you know, the advisory group, and we should back in here a little bit, unless you're going to get to it, because what was controversial about the, I saw it in 86. With all the best intentions, we're starting to worry about the structure and the look and the surface and all that. Mm-hmm. And Ed Myarecki's reconstruction that he was hired to do, not reconstruction, but just kind of, you know, upgrading, whatever, redressing, turned out to be really controversial. And I remember this the first year or two I was in LA, and even before we moved out here, but when I was around licensing, there was like an internal debate among some of the Trek people in licensing about the decision to go with the heavier grid lines. And the weathering look.
Oh, yeah.
That was like huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is esoterical. I can't believe anybody would be on this level of a nerd, you know, level here talking about this. But no, for real, it really gave the craft a different look. And that was the reconstruction. And then there was the other decision of, you have the pendulum swing, you have different politics, different people in charge. Now it's, well, this isn't a real craft. Why is it getting a big gallery? Yes, it's a treasure, but it shouldn't be up here with these stately actual aircraft and spacecraft. So that's when it went into the infamous all these years it's been down in the down by the gift shop and with a big clear plexi cage around.
That's where they moved it to. That was the last place before they
Right, but it's been down there for over probably 15 years or more down there, or maybe even 20 years by now. But yeah, so anybody that's taking pictures of it, they're having to shoot through, you know, clear whatever it is, and just that the placement and the way it's displayed, much less the way it was redone on its last time. So this, I'm so thrilled. They're fixing their mistakes. A, they're redoing it, but they got the team, you know, Mike and Denise Okuda, Rick Sternbach, Alan Schneider that headed up the Galileo restoration, our friend John Van Sitters from licensing, people I probably should be remembering and I'm not. But the team was, you know, I think fandom and the greater Star Trek community have a lot of faith, you know, and they're all people we can all be very jealous of. I know I am, of getting to be there. So this call comes out for really early pre-76. In other words, if you have stuff from or that early period. What was it, 76 to
64 to 76.
Okay, yeah, so pre-donation level. Now, what's interesting is, real quick, aside from my brother's photos, we did a story in Communicator. A guy sent me the information. I'd have to look it up. But it was in that weird window when Paramount thought that when Star Trek had been canceled, just like the first year or two, that period when they offered it to Gene for like nothing, and he just couldn't pull the cash together, or else he would have been a George Lucas and totally owned his own creation. Mm-hmm. But when Paramount was looking at everything, you know, newly Desilu purchased Paramount was looking at this thing like it was a white elephant, and they were trying to get rid of the stuff. They didn't want to pay for the storage. And within 2 or 3 years, that changed when the first syndication deal took off. But in that rare little window, a guy, and I forget his name, but he was in Arizona, attached to a museum, and we did a story on this and had photos. He basically wrote to them, and they were like, "Sure, yeah, if you pay the freight, you can have it for display." And they had it on display at a museum in like 70 or 71 for at least a short period of time, and then he packed it all up. And he was talking about in the story how it was a time when he almost wonders if he'd never sent it back. It's a lot like Paramount was like right after the Viacom divorce, and things were just kind of, there were so many new people coming and going, like in that 05, 06, 07 era. People had things on loan with Star Trek that there was a group in LA at a museum, totally legit. And if they had never written to anybody back at the studio, "Hey, we have to shut down. What do you want with this stuff?" If they had ever done that, nobody would have ever figured it out because everything turned over. And that's the way this was. If they'd never sent it back, nobody would have ever, might have ever claimed it, but he did. But we did have three or four photos from this public display, and I don't know if he's seen that. This has all just happened so fast that I haven't had time to jump on this. But it is a rare time, and it is kind of a narrow window, and it's the very, very, very beginning. But you know, let's hope that a lot of people have photos from that time. Mm-hmm. Maybe more people from the Arizona display visit when it was there, just for sure.
Yeah, it could be. So if you have photos from this time period, they want them because that's going to help them figure out the exact configuration and make sure that they restore it exactly the way that it needs to be. And they mention, there's an article on StarTrek.com with all this information if you want to go over there and check that out. And they mention that if you do have these photos, you can contact Starship Enterprise at si.edu, Starship Enterprise at si.edu, and let them know what you have, and they'll tell you how to get those photos to them. So if you want to be a part of helping this restoration happen, let them know what photos you have, and that'll be cool. And I'm looking forward to seeing the photos that people do have out there as well, especially stuff that we've never seen really, you know, in magazines or on websites or anything, because it's just from their personal collection. Could be cool. So the other thing, Larry, that we want to talk about ties into the original series, at least with the motion picture, and we just passed what would have been Robert Wise's 101st birthday, and he played a really major role in getting Star Trek to where it is now and making sure that Star Trek made a comeback after the original series had been canceled. And I think a lot of fans these days, because they're younger and they didn't live through those times, or they were kids at those times, don't really realize the importance of Star Trek the motion picture and the importance of what Robert Wise did, what his role was there. So do you have any thoughts on Wise and TMP and what we should remember, you know, as we mark his birthday?
It's very easy. In fact, it's almost like, you know, the more the years go by, whatever the standard line or the supposedly the standard meme on any aspect of Star Trek, it's been out long enough and our quote-unquote fallow time we're in has given people enough time to ponder, reflect on any aspect of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. That it's almost inevitable.
Who would do that? Who would spend time, you know, just talking all these stories from the past?
And I hope we don't get too geeked out here. I really do, Chris. And I hope, you know, heaven forbid that anybody on this show ever get into an extended conversation about anything getting too geeky, because we don't want to lose the audience. No, I think the motion picture, I was just looking at the date on the box. I can't believe the director's edition of the motion picture was from 2001 that David Fine and Mike Medicino and Darren Doctorman were in charge of with Robert Wise. Yeah, he passed away in 2005, which kills me. Wait, that was an unfortunate turn of phrase, but I'm shocked that it's been 10 years since he passed away, much less that this was his 101st birthday. But so he was working, they were doing that, you know, 5, 6 years, 7 years before he died. And he really did want it to be a legacy. But the common meme of the motion picture, of course, is, you know, to kick it around. And it's, you know, thank God there was Star Trek V for everybody to kick around, or they might be kicking around. You know, you don't have Dick Nixon or the motion picture to kick around anymore. Look it up, history buffs. But there's been time for some counter-reflection. The director's cut kind of did that. And I know Dave and Mike and Darren and a lot of people were back in the day big evangelistas of the motion picture deserves more respect than it sometimes gets in the common memery of things. And, you know, the last 2 or 3 years now with social media, I know there's at least one good Facebook page that's, you know, the Star Trek Motion Picture Appreciation Society, mm-hmm. people who stand up for. But it's with everything else about Star Trek. If you're not there week to week or year to year, which is eventually going to be everybody. Eventually, we're all going to be dead and gone, as my grandma would say. We'll all be dead and gone. And Star Trek, if its appeal keeps attracting year after year, generation after generation, new people, hopefully there will be new shows that people can experience week to week. But the original series, much less everything after that, you're going to know it as a Netflix binge watch queue, or your, you know, or a wall of boxes of DVDs or Blu-rays or whatever. And to go back and remember in the motion picture's case that the whole point of the motion picture was nothing like this had ever been done before, but people brought back a dead show, and it was a show that wasn't even brought back as another series again, but as a motion picture. And people survived through, because that was the whole point of Star Trek fandom in the beginning was, damn it, you can't take my show away from me. It's better than 3 years, and we're going to fight to get it back no matter what it takes in some form or fashion. And okay, well, the animates were good, but, you know, come on. And so you have all the little things like, oh, the tech manual is 16 weeks, is the number one bestseller on the New York Times list. Oh, my God. You know, the syndicated reruns taking off. You have all these, like, real-world business things happening. And then Paramount playing footsie. Will it be a small movie? Will it be a series? Will it be a bigger movie? We're going to launch our fourth network with it. Oh, now Star Wars is out. And it went, you know, there was this whole emotional, political football. And in the days before the internet and social media, I remember being a kid, I'd get little snippets in like these crappy syndicated columns that they'd stick into, you know, the local paper or the little bits and blurbs on the TV Guide news page and TV Guide where they would say, well, it looks like the fourth network is happening. Oh, it looks like the fourth network is dead. You're like, no, no. But you'd get like four lines and that's all you'd have. You know, if you were lucky or you were smart and you were into the burgeoning fan network and you were getting some kind of a news zine, maybe. But if you're 10 or 12 or 15 or whatever, you're probably not doing that. But yeah, so it was a whole long decade and the motion picture came out. And it's amazing. And it's a testament to the power of the movie and how long people have been holding their breath, literally 10 years, you know, before throwing a tantrum. That people went back and saw that it's still the number two until the JJ era, even with inflation adjusting, it was still the biggest box office movie because people really did go back and see it multiple times, especially when there was a little bit of a Star Wars rivalry and you thought, well, these idiots that saw Star Wars 47 times, we have to go see motion picture 47 times, even though we all did, I will admit to it, fall asleep in Act 3 at times. you know. But anyway, I'll take a breath. But we really do. There has been a whole movement to go back and reanalyze it, and that director's edition did help a whole lot because we have to remember the motion picture was rushed. You know, they had that deadline, that drop dead date of December 7th, which I always thought was ironic, and they had to crunch and shorten things. You know, Robert Wise's full vision didn't come out. He has this wonderful resume you're gonna mention here in a minute, but some people may think he was still living a little bit, maybe too much in the Andromeda strain, maybe even Day the Earth Stood Still, throwback to Kubrick's 2001. You know, and yeah. Space 1999 had just been out. Maybe he was thinking he was still stuck a little bit in the 70s look of sci-fi rather than maybe the Brave New World.
Yeah, it does feel like that, but I don't really have a problem with that because, I mean, I just watched the motion picture last weekend, and as long as I watch it in that mindset, because, you know, mm-hmm. I was a kid at that time, and I was watching these other movies that we just mentioned here, and if I watch it from that mindset, it's fine. I mean, it's what made sense at the time, but if you watch it only through modern eyes, then...
Well,
yeah,
it was a huge committee.
Feels different.
I mean, on one hand, it was a big political football because of that back and forth format. You know, they had the script writers in and out. Everybody from Harlan Ellison on down talks about Pitt. They had two British writers in to write a script. Gene's script about, you know, having Kennedy not be assassinated and changing history.
Yeah.
Part of the problem with bopping it around, kicking it around different formats was they could not agree all on a script. And that was a big football at the time. And finally, just the decision to take the pilot of the phase two series, they pulled the plug on, and building that up into an episode or into a motion picture script saved time. It wound up being problematical because everybody, you know, makes it a comparison to Nomad and The Changeling now. But it did have some bigger themes that way about the future, you know, that weren't part of Changeling. And we can talk about mm-hmm. that too. And some of that you get back to with that restored cut. But the whole point was Paramount trying to make a statement. And yeah, it was feeling like they were getting they were drowning and getting left behind in the great sci-fi craze of the late 70s after Star Wars, and all the studios had to have a sci-fi, you know, biggie. But the fact that they spent the bucks got somebody with the stature of Robert Wise in to do it. And you cannot deny that everything about the motion picture, you know, reeks of big picture, big quality that they never got back to until the JJ movies as a studio and just mm-hmm. as a budget. So, you know, and he walked into a big political, a logistical mess because there'd all been, all, you know, they inherited sets from the series and, you know, it was just a big mess to come into. And he'd had a long career by then. This is one of the last movies he directed, if not the last.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to that point, and to close out the discussion of the motion picture for right now, but bringing it back to him, the fact that he was so established and he had that long career, I mean, without his guiding hand here, do you think the motion picture would have made it to screen?
I haven't thought of it that way, but that's a good point. His own guiding hand and the gravitas that he had of a team that he put together. I mean, Paramount was so committed to this, you know, but it was like the commitment of having that drop-dead delivery day that all the theaters yeah. and having they were arm-twisting people to, you know, like, no, we're not going to have it. It may be 2 hours. We're not cutting it down. It will be here. You will do this. They really, really committed to it, and it almost, you know, they shipped the famous story of shipping the prints wet. They had the premiere mm-hmm. at the Smithsonian, there you go, again, the Air and Space Museum premiere, and he flew on the plane with the one print that had been assembled. You know, it was just like, that was December 7th? This was December 6th for premiere. He's on the plane to D.C. with the one assembled print while the other ones are being cranked out of every photo lab in Hollywood, you know, shipped with wet spots on the prints. So it's a good point. Could somebody else have held that together?
And if he hadn't, and if that hadn't happened, then, you know, the rest of Star Trek as we know it might not have taken form.
Well, that's true. Harv Bennett and Nick Meyer might not have had a chance to quote unquote save Star Trek again because they didn't save it the first time. But you have to go back and think about that. Gene and Robert Wise, and I, you know, Robert Wise had nothing to do with all the history and politics of Star Trek. He came in to do a movie, and I think I would like to go back and find some interviews with him at the time hopefully that were like longer form and not just snappy little entertainment interviews.
Yeah.
Where maybe he reflects on that. And I think there's some maybe long form film. I was looking here today about some longer form, like Academy, you know, archival things, where he can reflect on that a little bit. But I think he totally understood the fact that he was walking into something that was – I'm sure he understood the financial weight on his shoulders. Like, don't screw this up, because Paramount's put all their chips in on this for their sci-fi craze entry, and we want to build a tentpole out of this. But that is a good question. Yeah. It's so easy to kick the motion picture, but what would it have been if he hadn't been the guy in charge?
Yeah. I think a lot of fans these days, they don't even think about that, because it's just that film is so far in the past that maybe they've never even watched it. Or if they did watch it, they were like, okay, this is boring. I'm never.
I was going to say, are you saying they don't even like newer fans or younger fans don't even take the time to diss it? They just ignore it and bypass it?
Well, I think maybe they diss it without really giving it a chance.
Right.
It's just like they've heard – it's like the way the Enterprise was treated for most of the past decade. You know, it's like, well, I've never really watched the show, but everyone says it sucks, and so I'm also going to say it sucks.
That's what I'm saying. The meme takes over. The yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The common wisdom takes over until people like sit down. And like I said, then we have this big kind of pushback of the pendulum swinging back and people going, no, wait a minute. No, wait a minute. Let's look at this. And I know the director's cut did help a lot of that, because people got to, oh, they could see some of the visuals, especially. If it's supposed to be an epic motion picture, it's really hurts to have to cheap up a lot of the visuals, the visual effects. And not that that's the stereotype of the late 70s. Oh, we've got to out Star Wars on, you know, visual effects. Yeah. But there was
a
scope.
It was a lot harder to do all that stuff back then than it would be now. So,
but we are talking about this, you know, what does he say? 70 AUs in diameter, whatever the line is. But it's a huge, you know, V'ger was huge. And to get your arms around that visually, does that make sense?
Yeah.
That took a lot of, you know, a lot of, and to have to cheapen some of that down at the end, at the last minute, was a real burden.
Sure.
And I will still say that I totally love the first like third of the movie, the whole reunion aspect, the mission and the reunion. It's only when we get into the endless, you know, reaction show. And for one, you have to, last thing on this, people who make fun of the inspection tour, the pod going around the ship, they don't know that people had waited 10 years for that.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
That's hard to put back into people. You know, people, we love that. Just like we love that long lingering approach shot of the Klingons at the beginning.
Yeah.
I think that was the Katinga class, if I recall, although I don't think that was ever canon.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's the exact point. People had been waiting so, so long to see that. And I do love also that at the end of Nemesis, they pay homage to that with a flyby of the 1701E. And even musically, there's a musical cue, which is an homage to the motion picture as well, which is really nice. So,
and you had Jerry Goldsmith's score. I mean, Paramount just went all out and did it up in one of the first ways they did it up and tried to make a statement and said, respect people. We are going all out for this movie and this franchise is hiring Robert Wise. So, you know, West Side Story, Sound of Music, Sand Pebbles, Andromeda Strain, yada, yada.
Yeah. So thankfully they did. And he got the film together with his team to screen. So, and now we have all the rest of Star Trek. Yeah. Well, last thing in news before we go into the feature discussion, where we'll be joined by Shar from To the Journey, as well as Mike Sussman from Voyager and Enterprise, writer and producer, to talk about Voyager Season 7. I wanted to get an update from you, Larry, about your Portal 47 project, because the other day you had the inaugural trial call and you had a lot of people on this call. Tell us a little bit about how it turned out.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for asking, and thanks for helping me get the word out here early on. It's been a long time since I had an opening night feeling of a play, but that's what this was, because leading into this, I was, you know, I was wearing my entrepreneur hat, which I've been trying to learn here the last couple of years, and, you know, doing all the promotional work and the assembling the tech and then the content and then you know, just all the online pieces and everything, and doing it all myself. And I will say, in all the lead up to this, the last couple months, I'd been with you and everybody else, I'd been kind of intentionally coy, because Portal 47, and as you don't know by now, is what I finally have been trying to do for the last few years, find a way, a package of different features to try to get more of, you know, I say my archives, my memories, and my Rolodex of Trek people out to fans faster than our books and our magazines and our DVDs mm-hmm. and CDs and even the podcasts. And even the, you can only do so much of that so much at a time, and trying to jump on that and really give fans, you know, a deep dive experience right from where they are. So it's kind of like a mini con all year long. Although with some live events when we can do that, because we do live in the internet age and we can go global, but that's not great on having a live meetup unless we've got something like a convention or unless you're here in LA and whatever.
Right.
So yeah. The call Wednesday night was, I didn't want to give the details. I didn't want to talk about the plans. I wanted to wait till I could talk about it myself, but also show a little bit about what it would be. So the call Wednesday night, or we're calling them telebriefings, was we have two main formats when we do that. One is a round table, and I say a round table. It's kind of like everybody popping in to talk. The main thing is it's everybody's chance to pepper me. So instead of like a podcast where we're like having one-to-one people, it's whoever wants to jump in and bring up a topic or pepper me with something or pin me down to something or whatever. And not just me, but also get some good cross conversation going. It's also kind of what I've done at conventions when I've done a panel called The State of the Franchise. And a lot of people, mm-hmm. it's kind of like when you take the business end and the fandom end and the history end and the entertainment industry end and mix all that together, why things happened the way they did and all that. So that's one thing. And then I'm going to plan to have an interview telebriefing once a month too, and especially with people – like Mike, we've got Mike on tonight. Well, Mike was a writer. He's done interviews. He's been at conventions. There are a lot of people, and we will have those, but there have been a lot of people who have been on the cruise, who people don't know, who you'll never see at a convention, and have wonderful stories and wonderful insights, all the way from like the really insightful to just really the really funny. And I want to get those. I want to get them out and more exposed to people. So what I finally did with this call was give a couple of samples. And then, you know, basically had the commercial finally where we talked about all the features and how it's not just about the calls, but it's about archives, images and audio coming out of my archives and at live events, what we'll do. So that's all online now at my website, LarryNemechek.com/portal47. And the URL is going to be portal47.net because believe it or not, somebody has portal47.com.
I know. And you and I had a long conversation about what URL you should end up using for this.
I just went ahead and kept it simple and went with .net. And,
I think that's a good idea.
Why portal47.com is out there, I don't know. But I'm a strong believer in not negotiating with the terrorists. So I just went to .net for now. But, yeah. So there's a page with all the features down there on a monthly cycle. And then a page with the two plans, which is basically a 1 year every 12 months. And then there's a 3 month trial that's a little more month. And in all of this, I've tried to make something that makes sense for me, you know, as a business, but also is, you know, very affordable for a lot of our fans, most fans. And I would like to think that if they're in for the basically a year long subscription, that, you know, for the cost of a movie night out for two once a month, that that's something that's affordable. And then also they get a lot of value, and the deep dives that we get to take are more than worth it by the time you get all the stuff and the recordings and the downloads. And so we'll see how that goes. And I've had a lot of friends from a lot of fans and friends from the UK, from Germany, from other continents, Australia, and like the evening window. And I'm talking about the calls, the telesessions here. We're not Skyping. We're using conference call software channels. So bandwidth isn't a problem. And there's number management. But here's the thing. The more, and I've thought of this, the more bodies we have, then it'll make sense to break off. And one of the first things I want to do is say have an afternoon one here, which will be evening time for some of our friends around the world, you know, coming or going. So basically, the call Wednesday night, we had a ton of people on. A lot of people signed up. It went great. Mike Demerit was my first guest. We had like a little 20-minute sampler of what a roundtable would be like with some of our sneak peek early bird people who jumped aboard at the summer cons. And then I had about 20, actually more than 20, because it's so great talking to Mike, and he's a talker. I can understand how people can run shows long like that, but he's great to talk to. And then I kind of finally revealed the features and the plans. And I've done a bad job of it right here too. So there's probably about a dozen different pieces to the. So I just hope everybody goes.
There's
and
a lot.
Yeah,
to
don't
cover.
Take it from just what I'm saying here. It's just the call got a lot of attention because that's one of the coolest things. And again, I'm inventing this. I'm pioneering this. Nothing like this exists anywhere, much less in Star Trek. And it's going to evolve and tweak. And I'm trying to get that across to people. We may do some, you know, not so much course corrections, but as the new technologies get more diverse and cheaper and easier to use. We didn't do any visuals on this. We kept it audio only to be simple, but eventually we'll have visuals up, and then maybe we can do, especially when it's the guest, at least have the camera on the guest talking. But no, I was very excited. And what the only thing that screwed me up was I had some, you know, jump in right now. We've got some bonuses. And I totally forgot to, because I was juggling the tech and watching the, I felt like I was running a talk show, and I some of our members were a little slow. So I had a bonus surprise because I knew that Dave Rossi was gonna listen in, and I had pre-asked him just in case I had a blow up. Hey, I may call you out and let you raise your hand and talk. And he said okay. So the first 10 minutes or so, he jumped in and asked a couple of really cool questions that really got philosophical right off the bat. Which was great. So we did that, and then had some of the members chime in, and then we went and then we had Mike on by then. Didn't get the whole thing recorded. I had one little snafu on that because the members all get a, that's one thing. Everybody that's in the portal gets a recording of our major calls for the month. So that's part of it too.
Very cool.
So anyway, so no, I was very happy, but I forgot to mention the bonuses. So I don't think this will be up in time, but I wound up extending that for a couple of days. But I'll tell you what, Chris, by the time this is up, if anybody listening in tonight wants to jump in, even though it'll be after the midnight Sunday of this weekend, if you mention you heard this, send me an email, p47@larrynemechek.com. Mention you heard this on Ready Room tonight, and I will honor those bonuses, which is a free on-speaker CD, an actual call sheet from one of the later shows, and a bonus 13th month in the year.
Wow, that's awesome. Just this free CD alone is fantastic.
It's a $20 value, as we say in
I've been learning to say. Yes.
No, it's
Larry and I work very hard on those CDs.
Buy them. Yes. And you know of when you speak.
In this case.
You know of when you speak. But this has all been good because I've actually had a lot of people ordering the CDs or catching up and getting all three of them that are still in print. So yeah, that's been interesting. And a lot of people have been – and here's a sidebar too. I had a lot of people that wanted to get in and they were having difficulties on the tech getting in. I've had people tell me that they were a little wary because it was asking for name and email, and they thought that freeconferencecall.com was going to collect and spam their email. And to those people, anybody that came across that, I'll just say that was totally to give the host, i.e. me, a record of who's there. Anyway, I had a lot of people who didn't who tried to, or they held off getting on the call because the call was just a sample. Like I said, it was a sampler and it was like a pilot. And we're going to get ramped up and cracking. And people can jump on anytime. But I'll honor that bonuses one more time here for right now. And it's a whole month of activity. And like I said, once a year, if I'm guessing the convention near you, here's the live thing. If it's Vegas and San Diego or whatever, it'll probably be a large meetup party. If I'm out at, the Des Moines, I shouldn't say that because Des Moines probably has a very big Comic-Con. If I'm out at the little convention near you somehow.
What if you're at the Lick Skillet, Alabama Star Trek fan club? If you're within range of Lick Skillet, Alabama.
You know what? I think
Alabama.
I had an email from them. I think I have an email there from them inviting me. No, if I'm anywhere near any of our portalers, It's at least a drink and some snacks on me, however we can get together. So that's a live thing. And then also I'm gonna offer one day Trekland tours, kind of a small version, but it's my thing that we do with Terrace.
Yeah.
We'll have a menu of choices and people can like pick out four things and they'll be like half off or whatever it'll be for that, whatever price they come up
cool.
with. So there'll be some there'll be some live components to it too. But it's all there. It's all there at the site.
So LarryNemechek.com/portal47. That's up and running right now. And then coming soon will be portal47.net, right?
Right.
Which will
hopefully, by the time you've got this up, that should be pointing back to those pages.
It should be live by then. Excellent.
Yeah. But thank you for asking, Chris. It was really amazing.
Well,
and you know what? It was
great.
A lot like doing my first voiceover demo because you it's like you plan and plan and plan. It is like opening night, but then the minute it opens, it's like, okay, now you've got to keep it going. It's like, yeah, you lead into that, yeah. But it's like, now you've got to keep going. So that's been an amazing thing to add on to all my other projects. So, but thank you for asking.
No, it's great. It's really, really cool. So I hope everyone will go check it out. All right. Well, that's everything for the new segment. So let's go ahead and bring in Shar and Mike and talk about Voyager.
Can't wait for this.
Heading into Voyager's final season, there were a lot of questions on the minds of fans. Would Voyager get home? What was going to happen with the Borg? How would each crew member's story wrap up? And also there was that other Star Trek series in development. A lot was happening back in 2000, but luckily there was a lifelong Star Trek fan helping guide Janeway and her crew home. And today, that fan joins us to talk about Voyager Season 7, so please help me welcome to the Ready Room, Mr. Mike Sussman. Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Christopher. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here on the show for the very first time. And we're really looking forward to hearing kind of behind the scenes what was going on with Season 7 of Voyager. And also with us for this conversation, of course, is the co-host of To the Journey, our Voyager show, Mistress Shar Lynn Schmidt. Shar, glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me, and yes, to the journey!
To the journey!
To the journey!
Woo! I love it!
There's your new soundbite.
Yes! We might have to drop that in on occasion.
All right, so this is going to be fun, but Mike, before we get into all the Voyager stuff, I mentioned that you are a lifelong Star Trek fan, so tell us a little bit about how you first became a Star Trek fan and how that led you to actually working on the show.
Wow, how much time do you have?
It's the abbreviated version anyway.
You know, I was a child of the 70s and, you know, Star Trek was, you know, on, I think probably 6 days a week in Philadelphia where I was born and grew up. And I started watching the show. When I started watching it, the whole idea of a show being canceled was just completely foreign to me. I thought they were just making, you know, new Star Treks every day. And there was a new one on, Monday through Friday. The animated series was on Saturday mornings. And I was just living in this wonderful world where there was a brand new episode of Star Trek every day of the week, practically. Ultimately, I figured out that wasn't really the case. But yeah, I was a huge fan of the original show and, you know, the films as well. And as I, you know, got older and realized I, you know, wanted to work in the entertainment industry, that was right around the time Next Generation premiered, which I was super excited about and kind of, you know, set my eyes on, you know, coming out to Hollywood and knocking on the door over at Paramount. In fact, one of the first things I did is tell you how naive I was. When I got to Los Angeles, I picked up the phone, called the main switchboard at Paramount Pictures and said, please put me through to the Star Trek offices, please. And they did. And I asked them if I could come in and, you know, pitch a few stories, and asked me who my agent was. And of course, you know, I did not have an agent at the time. And they said, well, you know, I'm very sorry. We only accept, you know, pitches or from represented writers. And however, I did find out ultimately after going to one of the big Pasadena conventions, I found out about an internship program that they had over there. And they went through a new intern in the writer's offices approximately every 6 weeks. So I applied for that position, submitting, you know, a Star Trek next gen script that I'd written on spec, which actually very a Klingon story, if I remember. Anyway, they liked it and they called me up and said, "How would you like to, you know, come in, do this internship?" And, you know, it took probably like almost a year for that internship to happen because they had so many people waiting to just, you know, be part of that program. And on the very last day of that, of the internship, I sold the story idea to Michael Piller, and I came back the following Monday as kind of a working freelance writer.
And what was the story idea for the one you sold to Michael Piller?
Oh, that story that ended up becoming a the Voyager episode Meld.
Okay.
Oh, no kidding! That is one of my favorites from season two.
Yeah, that I only wrote the story, and Michael Piller ended up doing the teleplay, and ended up having to like really radically change the story because there just wasn't enough time. I mean, this is back in the day when they were doing, you know, 26 episodes a season, and they had, in fact, I think it was the episode before me or right around the same time, they'd given another brand new writer whose name I can't recall a chance to write a script. And as often happens, you give a chance to a new writer and they end up not being able to deliver. And then you're scrambling to, you know, have the writers on staff, the producers on staff, rewrite that script. And that's kind of where I came in. And they'd, since they'd already kind of given somebody else a shot at it, they couldn't afford at the moment to do that for me. So Michael Piller just kind of took the basic idea I came in with, which is the idea that, you know, my, you know, Tuvok mind melds with a serial killer who was played by, I think, Brad Dourif in that episode. And Tuvok starts to take on the qualities of this serial killer. So yeah, it ended up being a great episode. That was my first produced credit.
But well, what's great about that is that was second season of Voyager, and it was the last season that Michael worked like actively. So you got to work with Michael Piller.
Yeah, before. No, it was. Yeah. I mean, I think he had left for a little while to do. I think there was a show called Legend.
Legend
on UPN, and I guess he had just come back. And I didn't realize it at the time because, you know, he'd been, you know, there obviously at the beginning of Voyager and all through Next Gen, and I you know, certainly worshiped the ground he walked on. But I remember when I pitched him, one of my jobs as an intern was to summarize all of the spec scripts that the show would get. I wouldn't have to read them all, I'd read the coverage of the scripts that would, you know, some of them would have like, you know, crayon drawings of, you know, the Voyager, the Enterprise on it.
And, oh my gosh.
And, but you know, they were looking for story ideas. And if someone went to the trouble of, and this was all Michael Piller, because this was changed ultimately, as Larry, I'm sure you know, for legal reasons. If you went to the trouble to write a Star Trek spec script and would sign a waiver promising not to sue Paramount, they would read it and someone would summarize it and pass it on to, you know, what the general idea was if they liked it. So yeah, I had to comb through, you know, many scripts, and on like the last day of my internship, I was assigned to sit down with Michael Piller, and kind of summarize the ones that I thought didn't suck. And the problem is they all kind of sucked, but I had to have the meeting with Michael, and so I was pitching him, you know, as abbreviated fashion as possible. Well, I can't remember what they were, quite frankly.
You were doing coverage of the coverage.
Coverage of the coverage, exactly. Yeah, so yeah. I turned the coverage basically in the log line, and I'm like, well, you know, Tuvok runs. No, we don't want to do that. Although there was one story I remember where, I don't know why, 20 years later I'm remembering this, but maybe it would have made a good episode, where something, there was some kind of space anomaly, and it turned out that everyone on the ship was actually speaking their own native language all along. Like Tuvok was always speaking Vulcan, and I guess Chakotay was speaking some Native American tongue. And because the universal translator was also offline, nobody could talk to each other anymore.
Oh, that's funny. That is so funny you mentioned that most of the spec scripts absolutely sucked. The reason why I laugh so hard at that is because at the ripe old age of 13, I called that Paramount hotline to learn how to submit a spec script and did it. Who knows? You might have read my horrible, sucky 13-year-old script that I submitted way back in the day.
I didn't know you submitted a spec script, Char.
Oh, I did. That was my dream at 13. Wow. When I was really getting into writing, I thought I was going to graduate high school in 1999, and I thought, I have 2 years before Voyager ends to find a way to start writing for Star Trek. Wow. It was going to happen, and it was going to happen via spec script. I was going to find a way to get my foot in the door. So, Mike, you did my dream. It happened for you.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if it makes you feel any better, I submitted 3 scripts through that program long distance when I was living in Florida at the time. It was for Next Gen, but and none of them were accepted. All of them were rejected.
Do you still have those?
I don't have. No, I do not.
Do you remember what the stories were?
Well, yeah. The first one was a Klingon centric story that was just not very good. That I wrote again. This was like, I don't know. I want to say 89 or 90. It was before. What was the first big Ron Moore Klingon episode?
Sins of the Father.
Yeah, it was. Yep. So they hadn't done anything with the Klingons aside from, I guess, Heart of Glory or Hearts of Glory. Mm-hmm.
Heart of Glory.
And, I'm like a 18, 19-year-old fan, and I'm like, I want more Klingons. So I wrote a spec script involving Klingons, which they probably got, 5 of those a day.
Was it like a buddy story where like a Klingon and a Tribble team up and cruise around the Alpha Quadrant?
Have you been reading my spec script, Chris?
Well, I was just hoping that it was a Klingon and it was a Tribble, and they were also Bosom Buddies fans.
That would have been a much better story than the one I submitted. But anyway, they hadn't done anything with Klingons for a while, so I sent my script in, and literally like a day later, there was a preview for next week's episode of Next Gen, and it was Sins of the Father, which was, Klingon galore, and I was like, damn it. He beat me to the punch. That damn Ron Moore.
Who is this guy?
Yeah. One was probably the other story that they, Larry would know more about this than I would, that I think they got submitted all the time, which was a Jack Crusher story.
Oh, yeah.
Which they got a million of. So what was funny, though, is that I later submitted that Jack Crusher story separately to apply to the Voyager internship program and got in. However, they were not interested at all at Next Gen to, again, they were just looking at the idea. I'm sure as soon as somebody said Jack Crush and they said, we're not interested, what's next?
They used to have a big whiteboard that they had like about 47 categories of pitches, like, oh, the Jack Crusher stories, oh, the Q stories, oh, the Guinan stories, oh, the... They had one called Milk Carton. It was like, so-and-so goes missing and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, they would do like hash marks. And then occasionally one would sell and they would do a little dollar sign on it. But it was the big board to show people.
I remember that board. That board was there when I was an intern. Yeah, like, the ship comes between two warring parties. All of the horribly cliched ideas that, had already become cliches because Star Trek had done them so often. But... I submitted 3 terrible spec scripts, but somehow still, that speaks to persistence, Char. So if you, sadly, there's no one over there reading Star Trek scripts anymore. So,
right. And if Star Trek ever goes back to TV, I don't know if that option will be available, sadly.
Well, that's true. I mean, that was Michael Piller. That was Michael Piller, who really wanted to give a shot to new people. And, people like me got in that way. I think Ron did as well. I think Renee Echevarria.
Brandon did in that way too, right?
Brandon was an intern, but I think he went through the Academy program.
That's what I meant.
Right.
Intern, yeah.
Right.
The TV Academy program, and this was a Writers Guild program.
Oh,
but it was great. And there's very, it's so hard to break into the industry in any capacity. And everyone kind of starts as an outsider, and
I should say he did that also for his own sanity, because coming into the third season, like 5 or 6 shows in, totally way behind, and he was kind of desperate. But they kept that even after he wasn't actively there. They kept that all the way through DS9 and Voyager. And I think it broke with. I think that was one of the
Enterprise.
Things where they tried to break.
Yeah.
You didn't have spec scripts flying in.
I can't remember if it ended.
I mean, unagented spec scripts.
Yeah. By that time I wasn't really seeing them anymore. But yeah, I mean, there, it was a, I, I mean, I think they had a lot of legal issues. I mean, because so many ideas are very common. And I think at the time, you know, very often Paramount would end up just paying people off if they had mailed in something that ended up being close to an episode.
Well, the very reason why Hollywood doesn't do that is what finally happened. Mm-hmm. Even though people would fill out a release form, the kid in Iowa would see, you know, some script go by, and he didn't know that 12 other people had the same idea, but he would raise a fuss, and yeah, they would, and it got to where even the nuisance things were just sucking up too much time and attorney time, and
yeah, I mean, most shows don't even these days, even, you know, taking pitches from other professional writers, never mind non-professionals, is right. Like, for instance, when after I did an internship and sold a couple stories, I kept coming back every couple of months to pitch new ideas. One of the ones I pitched that didn't get made until season 7, there was an episode that I came up with a story, but Michael Taylor, a very talented writer, went on to write for Battlestar. That was an episode called Shattered. And I had pitched that, I think it was maybe it was like towards the end of season 6. I pitched it to one of the executive producers on Voyager, and they bought it. It turned out, I believe it was a writing team had pitched almost the exact same idea several months earlier, and that had been rejected. So when they saw my episode on the air, they assumed that somebody had basically ripped them off. And so Paramount ended up paying those writers off. But yeah, it's a very expensive proposition. But it's too bad we don't see more of that in this town. And that's why.
Well, let's talk about Voyager a bit. So you grew up watching TOS, and then you were pitching for TNG, and then you finally got on staff with Voyager. I'm curious what your feeling about Voyager was in terms of the shows and the types of stories that you were telling there, having grown up with TOS and pitched for TNG.
Yeah, well, I mean, I got to L.A. in 94, really. Well, the end of 93. So right as Next Gen was wrapping up. And I was, you know, I was a huge fan of Next Gen in the, you know, sort of, you know, the pillar era, you know, I guess, you know, season 3 on. So, you know, and Deep Space Nine was already a going concern. So, you know, and I certainly, you know, had been watching Voyager from the beginning with the idea that clearly this show was going to, you know, inherit the mantle of Next Gen, and I was going to, you know, get to know these characters as well as I possibly could and come up with, you know, a couple of great high concept stories that would summarize really well, as, you know, if you imagine the TV Guide logline of your favorite episode, and come up with a couple of great ideas that they couldn't say no to. And I found that that was a very difficult thing for me, because I sort of learned the hard way writing, you know, 3 very, you know, poorly received spec scripts for Next Generation, that as good as the writing may have been, the core idea of those episodes was very familiar. It was Klingons or Jack Crusher or whatever. So if that's all you were looking at, and no one was actually reading the scripts, if you're just like, what's the core idea here? You'd be like, we've heard that before. We don't want to do that. So I kind of turned it on its head and said, I got to come up with some really great ideas. And it turned out I wasn't too bad at that, and was able to come up with some cool notions that ended up, you know, selling. I understand you at least initially wanted to talk about season 7 of Voyager, which was my first year on staff on the show. But I think I ended up getting, I think I had like 7 credits on that one season, which was kind of crazy, because most of those stories I sold them as a freelancer. But it was a very sort of like fertile time, because everything I was reading, I was working in television news at the time. And if I ever came across a story that, you know, there was something about the 30th anniversary of the internet in like 99, and I had glommed onto that, and the big 2-parter Unimatrix Zero came out of that, just reading that New York Times article about the internet and cyberspace and where that was all going to go. So,
oh, wow.
It was a great time.
So the freelance scripts were actually Meld that you mentioned, and then The Swarm, and that was your story, and Jerry did the teleplay, and then now my mind is going back to the first time we interviewed, because I did a story with you, interview with you in Communicator 149. This whole thing made me get that back out and looking, not to dwell on this, but I'm just looking here at some photos that you sent us to put with that first time. One of them is you in a pool with a raft, and it has Enterprise on the raft. And I remember you told me the rest of your family had rafts, and you had like, what, like Defiant and Constellation or whatever on.
Yeah, my that was growing up in Florida. My brother Bob is a huge Star Trek and Star Wars fan.
It looks like you put like a little Delta shield on every T-shirt you ever wore in all these pictures.
Larry, the problem was that their Defiant raft, it disappeared and they can never find it. And that was the genesis for In a Mirror Darkly on Enterprise. That's why Mike wrote that story. Right?
Okay, Chris. Now, I've listened to a couple of your shows. I know you're not a fan of those episodes.
No, Mike, I actually like...
This is a Voyager show.
Let me just say, Mike, because you've told me that before as well, that I know you don't like this. I like the stories fine to watch them. What the thing with me about them is that people so often point them out as being their very, very favorite Enterprise episodes, and I think they're very different than the rest of Enterprise, and so that's what I'm always saying.
Of course. I think for some people, I mean, look, I totally get it. I'm just giving you a hard time, you know that. you know, those episodes came at the end. I don't know why we should, you know, talk about Enterprise at the time. However, they did come at the end of the run of the series, and it was a little bit of a departure for people who wanted to see the characters that they love, not necessarily their evil Miriams.
Right.
So I totally get that.
Some of my favorite DS9 shows are all the atypical, like Little Green Man and Armand Bashir and you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, I imagine, you know, I think there are probably, what, Deep Space Nine fans are called Niners. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. You know, when they do surveys, often, you know, the most popular episode of Deep Space Nine is Trials and Tribulations, which is obviously a TOS homage.
Right.
So,
right.
That probably drives them crazy. So I
shake
your...
my fist. No, I love that episode too. All right. Well, I got us down a rat hole here because you said there was a raft named Defiant. So, Larry, go ahead.
I was just looking at the other, like this other picture where you're like you're at the beach in the sand and you're wearing a T-shirt that says Klingon Power with kind of a animated style.
Yeah, you know what that was? That was. Do you remember when the model kit, the AMC kit in the mid 70s had a mail in iron on offer. If you bought the kit and you sent in like the receipt.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. You got several.
My older brother told me about it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. But that's one of the iron ons that I got from AMT. I'm probably like 6 or 7 years old, I think, in that picture.
So I guess so Meld, we talked about the Swarm, which was an idea that got greatly mogrified, and then the Swarm, and I don't know, and then Jerry did that. I mean, maybe you could say real briefly how that evolved. I was looking at those pictures again. I remember the first sit down we did where we went through a lot of your back history like this and then got into writing. And at the time, I guess Enterprise was a year or two into, so we even got into Enterprise. But I remember, wasn't there a story about the haunting of Deck 12? Because Unimatrix Zero was your story, but you didn't do the teleplay. So I'm trying to remember, weren't you like, you got sucked into saving haunting of Deck 12 and then couldn't do the teleplay for the story that was your idea?
Well, what happened, your hope as an aspiring writer is to get on staff for the show. And often what will happen is you'll come in, you'll get to pitch the producers an idea, and you pitch them many. And if you're really lucky, they might like one out of, you know, maybe 20, which would actually be incredible odds if they like that many. But if you're lucky enough to sell that idea, maybe you'll get a chance to write it, maybe you won't. More often than not, you have to then sell a second idea, which might take months or years later, and then you come in, and then the idea is that we'll now give you a shot at a teleplay, which can be a very expensive, time-consuming proposition for a television show that's in production, because odds are that new writer, in this case it was me, is not going to be able to deliver, certainly not on a first draft, the kind of script that you can, you know, run before put before the cameras. So I'd written Meld, or written the story, and Michael Piller did the teleplay, and I had done Swarm, or an episode that ended up becoming The Swarm, which was really, when I sold it, was kind of a quiet story about the doctor coming down with sort of an Alzheimer's type condition. And it and they ended up having to, I think there was pressure from the network to kind of make the show more exciting and sexy. And so there became this whole alien element. And the story really, the episode really changed. And Jerry Taylor did a lot of writing on it. And so anyway, I came out of that experience. I hadn't really impressed them. They weren't really blown away by my work on it, which, you know, I get it. It was not a great, I liked the parts with the doctor and with Dr. Zimmerman and Cass were kind of sweet, but the rest of it, I didn't nail. So I'm pitching more stories, hoping against hope to get another chance to write a teleplay. So, I pitched a story that ended up, they ended up buying, which was Unimatrix Zero, which again, I think one of the ideas they had on the board that they didn't want to hear from anybody were Borg stories. And I was dumb enough to actually come in with a Borg story that they ended up buying. But the problem I ran into, which was somewhat unique, is they liked the story too much. They liked it so much, they wanted to make it a two-parter and to make it the season ender for season six of Voyager and make it the season premiere. And I was still an untested writer. So I had kind of done my job in that I pitched them a story they liked, but I'd done it too well. They weren't going to let me write this story, either part, or write the teleplay. So how was I going to get a chance to like demonstrate that I had learned my lesson and that I could write a decent Star Trek episode? And so they gave, as a consolation prize, they said, well, there's a story we're working on. We can't quite crack. And it ended up becoming The Haunting of Deck 12. Which was kind of a tortured experience in its own right. So to make it up to you
here, try to defuse this bomb that no one else can.
With the upfront explanation that Rick Berman already didn't like this story, and I had a very tall mountain to climb, and he didn't like it anymore after I had turned it in.
So what was the process like? You said it was a tortured experience.
Well, it's just, I mean, again, this is back in the day when I think that was like episode 24, 25 of season six. So, you know, they had kind of like a notion of Neelix telling a ghost story, but they didn't quite know. It ended up being a kind of a fun Neelix episode at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
But the story I was given was a 7 of 9 B'Elanna story, which didn't work at all. In fact, I was the one in my original draft. I kept pulling the Neelix out of it and making him the more central character and giving him a lot of funny things to do. And they, you know, I turned in my draft and they kind of took those Neelix elements and blew that up into the whole story. And I think Ken Biller and Brian Fuller did a rewrite on that.
Yeah, they've got it.
Yeah, and it ended up being kind of a, you know, a charming little thing. I mean, it wasn't the Borg episode that I had hoped to tell. But
what was the 7 of 9 B'Elanna story?
God, honestly, that was the problem. There was no real story. The idea was that they were kind of, you know, the ship was in trouble, and they were trying to work together, but they didn't really like each other. I mean, it was so vague, and there was no sort of central, you know, thesis there. Exactly. Okay.
Sounds like season 4, 7 in B'Elanna.
Yeah. It was like a throwback. It was very familiar. So
I thought you were going to tell us that there was a version of it that was a follow-up to Macrocosm, which was called The Hunting of Deck 12, where Janeway got her biceps out again and a big rifle turned into Rambo around the ship.
I love that.
No, that was unfortunately not the case. That would have been a much better episode.
but the good thing was you actually, that was like your third trial by fire, and you actually survived that and came out.
Well, after that, I was like, that's it. I'm done. I'm done in Star Trek. They gave me 2 teleplays over several years. I burned through every possibility, and that's the end. And then I got a call a couple months later from Ken Biller, who, you know, by the way, was my supporter from like the get go. He was the one who had read my Next Gen spec and invited me in to be an intern initially. And he's the one ultimately who put me and my then writing partner, Phyllis, Phyllis Strong on staff on Voyager in season 7. But Ken had called and said, you know, we kind of threw you a curveball there with the Haunting of Deck 12. And so, however, we'd like to give you another story to give you another shot at a teleplay, your third time at bat.
Third time's charm.
And the one they ended up giving me, and I was at this point, I was working with Phyllis because clearly I didn't have any talent and needed all the help I could get. but that episode ended up becoming Body and Soul, which was a 79 Doctor story, which was, you know, a lighter one and a comedy in the certainly Star Trek's version of it. And that script was well received. I was told Rick really liked it, and Phyllis and I were hired on staff at that point.
And that was that we talk about you. I'd forgotten this till I started digging a little bit, but that was actually like the seventh show. So you weren't, it wasn't like the sixth season ended and they said, Mike, come on board for seventh season. It was, they were several scripts in.
Yeah. We
joined, you had the majority of the year, but it wasn't like at the beginning.
No, it was not the beginning. We joined sort of, I guess maybe like a quarter, like you said, like about a quarter of the way, into the year.
Cause what I was going to get to was, the whole point of the seventh season of, or one of the things about the seventh season of Voyager was Brannon stepped back to go develop Enterprise with Rick,
right,
and handed the reins off to Ken to actually be day-to-day showrunner that year. So I started to say, what was the vibe different? But I think you've said a couple of times too, you didn't really, you came in as a freelancer with Brannon, but you didn't really work under him as a staffer. So the whole thing about, you know, Ken taking it, what the vibe was different, the dynamic was different, or maybe you do have some insight there.
Well, yeah, I didn't really know.
I mean, aside from Ken hiring you.
Right. You know, Ken hired me, and, you know, as he has reminded me on, you know, more than one occasion, I owe it all to him. You know, Ken and I later went on to create a show for TNT called Perception, a crime show starring Eric McCormick that finished up, you know, three seasons last year. Mm-hmm. So Ken and I had a, you know, wonderful, you know, fruitful collaboration for a long time. Yeah, we worked on, you know, 44 episodes of Legend of the Seeker, a little Disney syndicated show some people may have heard of. But yeah, I hadn't really worked with Brannon too closely. But Phyllis and I had, you know, done, you know, worked with Ken and written several episodes for, you know, season 7 of Voyager. And, you know, Brandon, so I got to know Brandon a little bit, and Brandon then hired us on Enterprise. In fact, we were the first writers whom he hired for that show. And it's funny because even though we were working, you know, on Voyager, we knew there was a new series in development, but it was all very hush hush, top secret. Nobody knew what it was about. And then I remember, I don't know, it was probably like maybe March or April of 2001, where we got a call to go into Brandon's office. And Brandon said, here's a script. Rick and I have written a script called Enterprise. It's a prequel to the original series. You guys should go on vacation right away. You're done with Voyager. And read it. Hope you like it. We'd like you to, you know, be the first writers working on this new show, and which was an incredibly exciting moment for certainly for me. And that was the beginning of my working relationship with Brannon, which, you know, then lasted all, you know, 4 years of Enterprise, and then 13 episodes of a show called Threshold on CBS. And he lives just a few blocks from me. I see him every now and then over on Larchmont Boulevard. Good guy.
So I don't want to put this in a negative light, but it kind of sounds like as Enterprise was getting ready to go into production, it just sounded a little bit like, well, Voyager, you were on your way out. Bye-bye. Was that, bye-bye. I mean, is that accurate?
Oh, I was
going to ask you that too. Yeah.
On its way out. I mean, I think by the time that conversation had happened, I was, you know, the rest of the show wasn't, Voyager wasn't done filming, and even the writing wasn't done, but
sure, but they knew they were in the seventh season. They knew it was going to be the last going in anyway.
Oh yeah, completely. But you know, all the remaining scripts were in the process of being written. You know, it was very late in the year when that phone call had happened.
Okay.
And you know, also when you're a new writer on a show, you know, you're, it, again, it's so different now where, you know, so many shows are serialized and there are far fewer episodes, but mm-hmm. you know, when you're doing 26 a year, you're jumping around. You're writing episode 4 and then you're working on episode 9 and then you know about the other stories and you read them as they come out, but you can't be in on all the breaks. So you often end up just kind of concentrating on the ones that you were responsible for and don't have like as complete a picture as you might think. So,
gotcha.
You know, I have obviously very, you know, I think I have a fairly decent memory and recollection of the episodes I worked on that year. But, and also when you're brand new, you're just, you know, you're terrified you're going to get fired at any moment. So, yeah. Uh-huh. And as you're, you know, as you're continually reminded, you're only as good as your last script.
Right.
And there was a script I had that Phyllis and I had written that was based upon a story written by Larry Nemchek.
Prophecy,
which I think ultimately turned out to be a fine episode, but the script that I had written with Phyllis was somewhat troubled, and it was another instance of you know. An idea that was difficult to execute ultimately. And I'm not sure, had that been my final Star Trek Voyager script, I don't know that Phyllis and I would have been invited on board. I'm being dead serious here. It was a very troubled script. And I know Ken was not happy with the work we'd done on it. However, I think we redeemed ourselves with
Author,
yeah. Which was based on a Brannon idea. But yeah, had we gone out on Prophecy, thank you, by the way, for that, Larry. That was almost derailed my career again. been many opportunities. No, it was a fun episode, and just writing that whole teaser sequence where you're out in the middle of the Delta Quadrant and suddenly a Klingon battle cruiser decloaks and starts attacking was like, I was just like in ecstasy just writing those words.
Yeah, I had a total fanboy moment when I first saw that episode. It's actually one of my favorites from season 7 because Klingons in the Delta Quadrant, what?
Yeah.
And you had a great take on why they were out there, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, as Larry, I'm sure, can tell, that story was kicking around for quite a while. And mm-hmm. But then the whole B'Elanna pregnancy tied into it in a really wonderful way, and it suddenly, I think, made sense to do that story.
Yeah, I thought it came together nicely.
And Larry knows I was just giving him a hard time. Thank you, Larry, for that opportunity.
Well, no, I've told this story on at least 47 different Trek FM shows, but that was actually pitched. That was like, you're talking about the things that beat the odds or go.
Well, we did whatever. A Ready Room on that, Larry. Remember?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Way back early on. But that was actually, you know, and I remember Lolita on Down saying, "Now you never sell in your first session." Well, the only thing we ever sold to either show was the first pitch session.
Right.
And I like to think it wasn't Jerry just being nice. But then later on, I had at least two different people elsewhere in the entire like family of you know, the crew, from the offices down to the stages. I had two different people go, "Well, I pitched that same idea, Klingons the Delta Quadrant. Why'd they buy yours?" I'm like, I don't know what, you know, whatever. But we sold that December before Caretaker aired. And you're right. Yeah, then it kept getting bumped down the road for one reason or another. Oh, it's Alpha Quadrant. We've done too much Alpha Quadrant. Oh, Worf and the Klingons are on DS9. We can't pile on, which to me seems like they should have done.
So it was 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, no, it was there the whole time. We sold that before the pilot aired. They were about 5 or 6 in shooting. But then it's for 2 or 3. And then after 2 or 3 years went by, I said, they're never going to do it. We got paid, but they're never going to use this. And then that last summer when I went around to say hi, when everybody came back, and Ken said, "Oh, Larry, we're trying to find the note." Ken remembered that because he was the rookie writer first season. And because our writers, story meeting, because Brannon didn't come down, and that was first season. And it was just Michael and Jerry and Ken and Janet and me. There wasn't anybody else on staff. Right. And Brannon would have been there, but he was off probably writing. But Ken remembered it, and he asked me about the notes, and I always likened it to like where the Ark of the Covenant was buried in the government warehouse. Nobody could find the stuff, so we pulled our notes out
And I said, Janet, don't go crazy, but they actually might do this. But so we didn't tell anybody till it went down the pike. But yeah, so it wound up what Raph and Ken took a turn, had to update the story,
right?
You know, to make her pregnant and married, and then change it around. And then you guys had the teleplay. So there's like six names on it, which is it's either the recipe for disaster or it's a recipe for another Yesterday's Enterprise. So
right. yeah, no, I mean, there were many places where it could have gone south, but yeah, I mean, ultimately, when you're, it's Klingons, man. There hadn't been a Klingon show in a while, so it was a lot of fun.
With one of the outstanding Neelix scenes of the whole series.
Oh, the best one, I think. Yeah, he loves the Klingons, especially the ladies.
While we're on Prophecy, Larry, I know that you want Mike to tell his part of the D7 story, which I should point out is a very sneaky 47 reference, the D7.
Mm-hmm. weren't you trying to get a D7 used? The whole thing was to use a D7 for the Klingon ship and Jeff Mandel, they actually did the big graphic on the bridge set as a D7, but then they got down to the visual effects and they were like, oh, we don't have a digital version of it. We don't have a model. So, and it happened again in Enterprise too, right? Like trying to get the D7 actually on screen, not a Katinga.
I wrote into the script that it was because your pitch was that it was a 100-year-old
right
Klingon battle cruiser,
which could have been a Katinga, but yeah.
By the way, I always thought those were the same ship anyway. I mean, just as the refit, and we're going to get totally nerded out here for a second. We're going to go deep.
Mike.
The Katinga was called the D7 Mark II, right?
Well,
using Canon's camera naming scheme.
Is it canonical? I mean, seriously. I mean, I know it was in the novelization of Star Trek, the motion picture. Yes, I know this shit.
That's where it came from.
It was never. When was Katinga ever used in an episode?
It was. It's from Gene's novelization. That's the only
thing. Okay. Well, all right.
Right. Unless Mike got it into some little obscure graphic somewhere, you know.
Okay. So, well, I know certain people in certain quarters were very upset by the whole K7 or D7 Katinga thing, but I don't know. It just says the movie Enterprise and the original series Enterprise were both the same class. It seemed to me that the D7 and the Katinga were, in fact, the same ship. I am done nerding out. That's the end.
Wow. Okay. Because there was a refit, but no, because it also the whole flathead, bumpy head thing. Like, did you go through that when you were, you know?
Oh, well, yeah. I think for like 3 minutes, there was the thought of like, hey, are they going to look like the way, you know, Klingons did in the original series? And it was very clear that no, we were not going to be doing that. But yeah, so there was one line of dialogue where I think Tom Paris says, hey, I think that's a D7 battlecruiser. And there have been many, many discussions in various quarters since then about that error. I put error in quotes, air quotes.
Well, you know, Tom was just going off the top of his head. He was into his history kick, and, you know, he can't be perfect. It wasn't a car, so he couldn't be, you know, perfect all the time.
We're going to edit out all this Klingon stuff, right? Because
what is it, too geeky?
Your listeners are going to love this.
They're going to love it.
Yeah, I was going to say,
you're on a Star Trek
interview.
Podcast, Mike. I don't think there's such a thing.
Yeah, you can't get too geeky. It's not possible.
No, no such thing.
But no, I when I wrote that line, I thought they were going to use the physical model that they built.
Trials and
Tribulations. Yeah. But at this point, of course, you know, I was a new writer on the show, knew very little about the post-production process. And at this point in the run, everything they did was CGI, and that model was long gone, and so it never even occurred.
We don't want to shoot motion control. We just want it. Yeah.
Yeah, everything was digital, which was news to me. That's why that error creeped in, and I'm sure I would have otherwise changed the designation.
So, Mike, while we're talking about villains from the past, we talked about Unimatrix Zero a little bit, and of course the second part leads into season 7, but I'm just curious, you know, coming from the Borg on TNG and through Voyager, and, you know, fans often talk about how the Borg turned out by the end of Voyager, but here we're still end of season 6, beginning of season 7. what are your thoughts on like the Borg when you were working on it for that story? And then what do you think about how it turned out at the end where we can just kind of, you know, negotiate with the Borg and
move on? You mean in Endgame?
Yeah, but I mean, just as someone writing the Borg for the story for Unimatrix Zero, and then you didn't write any more Borg-specific stories after that. You know,
not for Voyager, although I ended up writing Regeneration for Enterprise, which is a
great episode, I think.
Thank you. But yeah, that's a whole nother story. Yeah. But
those are Borg in a different time period, so.
Yeah, I mean, when I came up with when I pitched them the idea for Unimatrix Zero, I wasn't even like on the staff of the show, and I had no idea what they were, you know, wanting to do with the Borg. It turned out they were looking to do a show where Janeway and some others were going to like be deliberately assimilated and infiltrate the Borg, and so I think they were looking for a good Borg story to kind of marry that with. And so when I pitched them the idea that, that the Borg in their regeneration cycle were actually in some kind of cyberspace realm, that kind of evolved into this notion that, well, what if there was a bit of a Borg rebellion in there? And my original idea, which I wish they had gone with, was not that Seven was going to have a romance with somebody, but that she was going to find her father, right? Magnus, was that his name? Mm-hmm. And that he, you know, was a brilliant scientist who was studying the Borg, you know, as they established, and that he had somehow, you know, even though he had been assimilated, found a way to create the cyber realm and was now recruiting his daughter to help him and the others lead this rebellion. I thought that could be like a wonderful Seven father-daughter story. For reasons I don't know, they privy to, they didn't want to go there, and it ended up becoming a romance, which I don't know, it just to me wasn't as effective as that existing father-daughter relationship.
I like your idea better.
Me too.
I really do. That would have, I think, had more emotional pull myself. I mean, Seven could have a romance with anybody. She had a romance with Chakotay, for crying out loud.
I had nothing to say.
I had forgotten that. But you're right. That's a father-daughter dynamic is something that we don't get much of on any Star Trek. So
no,
yeah,
it would have been so good.
You know, and when we saw that character, she was, you know, she was little Annika. She was just a little girl, and we'd never really seen, you know, Jeri Ryan and that actor. And so I thought that would have been a great way to go, but they went another way with it, and that's fine. It's their show. So that was my original. You know, I didn't really, you know, have any particular take on the Borg aside from like that idea. And, you know, Endgame was a script that, I think Ken had written with, Rob Doherty. And, I even think I'd been part of the break, cause Phyllis and I were writing Renaissance Man, which was, I think, episode 24 that year.
It was actually 25. It was like the last, the penultimate.
Next, yeah.
Well, I guess
it's 24. I'm sorry, 24. Yeah.
So I had very little to do, in fact, nothing whatsoever to do with the Voyager finale, which you know, ended up being a big, grand, you know, wonderful, end to the series. But I can't even remember if there was even any follow up to what had happened in Unimatrix Zero, quite frankly.
I'm trying to remember this too, because I didn't get to talk to him at the time, and I did later on one of the shows you all were doing at that point. I said, we sat down and talked about some of this stuff. Of course, it was 10 years later, which I hate because you're not as fresh, but did he just basically take that and I'm trying to see if he had, well, I don't have it called up here, if he had a credit with Raff or if it was only his credit, but did he pretty much, as far as him and the staff, did he like just sequester himself and write that himself and like even a story break and people weren't throwing, pieces.
You know, it's funny. Honestly, I can't remember.
You were busy, but I don't know who else was on staff that would have been excluded as well if he was just doing it, you know, in his own room.
Yeah, I don't think that's what happened. Ken is a very collaborative person. That he and Rob worked quite a bit together on that. And I'm pretty sure there was a regular story break. But again, I was so busy with the episode before that, trying to, you know, turn Renaissance Man into, you know, a shootable episode, that I really didn't have a whole lot to do with Endgame. I thought it was a terrific finale. And of course, that's where you get the, you know, your little catchphrase that,
I'm
not going to say.
Before we skip over this too much, because I know Char had talked about this, was one of her favorites, and I was looking at the credits, and I see you are a part story credit, so maybe it wouldn't wind up ultimately, and Rob did the help. But Repentance,
yes.
Your name is on there.
Yes.
Yeah. That was something I pitched to Ken, maybe 3 years before. And I'm trying to remember.
They're really cleaning out the closet as they got down to the. They took our old story out of the mothballs and this and.
Well, what happened was Brannon was, as you pointed out, taking a step back from Voyager in order to work on the pilot for Enterprise, and Ken, who had been with Voyager for the entire run, was taking the ideas that he had liked now that he was going to be showrunner. And the ideas he remembered, such as yours, Larry, and pitches he had liked, some of which were mine, and putting them into development. So Prophecy was something I had pitched him. Or not Prophecy, I'm sorry.
Repentance.
Repentance was a notion I had pitched him about a, I'm trying to remember now, it was sort of loosely based on Carla Faye Tucker, who was a woman. I hope I'm not misremembering her name. Might be a lawsuit involved. It was a very, awful story, a true crime story about this horrible series of murders. But this woman had sort of a conversion while in prison and had become very religious and was very sorry for what she had done and become a model prisoner. However, she was now on death row in Texas. And were they now going to execute this person for having done this terrible thing? And yet now people were arguing that she wasn't the same person anymore. She wasn't the same person who had committed these awful crimes. And I thought, that's kind of a science fiction premise in a way. So, and that became a story about the doctor being able to basically cure somebody of an illness, a compulsion to murder. So it was another one of these stories that I had taken from my work in television news that I thought
really
was very
cool
interesting.
To know. I figured it was a ripped from the headlines kind of a thing, but I had no idea which story it was.
Yeah, which means it was written well.
And I feel like that's a really underrated episode. Yeah. There's so many different perspectives on the criminal justice system and what makes a person violent. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I just very recently watched it and really got a lot out of it this time.
Well, Rob Doherty, who, very talented writer, who's gone on to, create Elementary on CBS. He certainly knows how to write a crime show. Mm-hmm. Did a great job with it. I was disappointed that I didn't get to all these years later. I did not get to write that one. It was kind of somewhat ironic in that I had sold a bunch of ideas to Voyager, but because of the rotation, the way things episodes come up, and what they need to do next, we need a Chakotay story, we need a 7 to 9 story. I ended up not writing the stories I had pitched. I ended up being given other stories, such as Larry's, and kind of been told to pick them up and then run with them. And sometimes it's a lot harder than when you kind of come in with your own notion that you're excited about and you know what it should be.
Oh yeah.
It's a job. It's like, here's a story and we hope you like it. You need to turn it into a teleplay. Meanwhile, that idea that you came in with that you're really excited about, we're giving that one to Rob. So, but Rob did a terrific job at that. And
he started as Ken's assistant, right?
Yeah, I think Rob and
he came
both
in with an eye toward building a writing career. He was very serious at the time. I remember that in pitching and
completely.
He wasn't just a blow off kid answering the phone.
No, but I think he did the same internship I did. I think maybe just a couple of weeks or months after me. But Rob's a very talented guy.
I wanted to ask you about the doctor because. You look at Body and Soul, you could author, Renaissance Man. You and Phyllis did a lot of stories about the Doctor. Was he one of your favorite characters on Voyager?
Yeah, I think that's probably true for a lot of fans of the show. You know, Bob Picardo did such a terrific job. I think he was, you know, a breakthrough character for the show. You know, aside from the story that became The Swarm, which was really a, you know, a story about the doctor losing his memory. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that that pitch, and again, this was like a season one, season two idea when I pitched it, was that, you know, the doctor would, as they had established, was never designed to be operated as long as he was. So he was basically running out of RAM was the pitch, and he was starting to break down. And what would that look like? And I thought, well, I could do a sort of an Alzheimer's type story here and find a way to kind of learn more about how the doctor was written. And you bring in the Louis Zimmerman character who they had talked about, but we had never seen, and do a father-son story basically. And so that had excited me initially about the doctor. But then later, yeah, we were, I think Phyllis and I were, you know, very fortunate that author, and then both Renaissance Man, which were stories that other writers had come up with, kind of landed in our lap. And we got to write those teleplays, and they were both very heavily involving Bob Picardo's character. But he's such a delight to write for. In fact, Ken and I hired him on Perception to guest star as a, he played an author, a sort of Whitley Strieber type author who was signing books at a science fiction convention, who was convinced that aliens were coming to get him. he did a great job of it.
Yeah, he was, for me, a real standout from the very beginning of Voyager, and the Doctor was one of my favorite characters throughout. And then as the show went on, Tom Paris became one of my favorites. But yeah, the Doctor, just such a fantastic character.
Yeah,
he always shined.
Honestly, you know, I wanted to see the Doctor end up with Seven. That was my I think that was probably Bob Picardo's hope as well. I thought they made a terrific team.
Yeah, but the whole unrequited love thing they ended up doing with someone to watch over me, that really did work.
That was a terrific.
Oh, the guy doesn't always get the girl.
Yeah.
And then you had the big scene in Renaissance Man, wasn't it?
Yeah, he confesses his love for her. Yeah. I mean, that was something that I threw in because I thought he absolutely loved it because he thinks he's going to die. He's going to decompile. And he just tells her, I love you.
And then, that's what you do when you're going
to
die.
They flip the switch and he's fine and he kind of has to live with it. And, you know, then the series ended.
Two more episodes. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
It wasn't really time to get into it after that point. But at least, you know, he got to tell Seven he loved it.
He did get that.
I was very proud of that moment.
I had a thought, too, here. Since the last season, everybody was already focusing on, a lot of people were focusing on Enterprise on the upper levels. Like Brandon stepped back, and Kenan was running the show. So Brian was on staff, and we all know what he's gone on to do. Rob's gone on. There are Michael Taylor. Michael Taylor worked on Defiance, at least the first year or two also. But there are a couple of names that people that were just in that 1 year, probably Ken hires. Maybe just for people, and I don't know if you're particularly close to any of them. I think I did sit down, and I've got interviews in the can with these guys. Again, my hour or two that should be got out to the public or at least transcribed. But maybe you could talk about some of these names that are just going by on credits that people that don't have interviews, they're not on DVD, whatever. It's like Raff and James Caan. And I'm trying to – I was looking through back some names. They're just
– Yeah, no. Raff Green, a very talented writer. I met him on Voyager, and he ended up – he worked with me and Ken on Perception for several years. James Caan, I remember, had written, I think he'd written Critical Care. Mm-hmm. And I'm forgetting the name of the B'Elanna episode. Oh, Lineage, the one with, where she learns.
She's pregnant.
Yes, right, exactly.
Well, the DNA, do you genetically change your.
Right, yeah. Was she gonna have a human baby or a Klingon child? I remember that being a good episode. I mean, there was a terrific group of people there, and you know, as you pointed out, Brian Fuller, you know, very talented guy, had a lot of ideas, and you know, I think by season seven, though, I think a lot of people had been with the show for a while, and a lot of them were ready to move on. I mean, they'd done good work. I had just sort of gotten there, and I was thrilled to, you know, be invited to stick around for the next show. But a lot of the other writers had their shot at it, and I think were happy to try other challenges.
As a hypothetical, Voyager, of course, ends with Voyager getting home, and I always thought that it would be interesting, though I knew they would never do it because it's Star Trek, but I thought it would be interesting if Voyager got stuck in the Delta Quadrant and they didn't make it home. Just as a writer, as a storyteller, going through season 7, did you ever have any thoughts about how you personally would want to see Voyager end in that season?
You know, it's... I remember, I mean, sort of vaguely.
Because I was going to ask you, Mike, real quick. I'm trying to remember myself, because there's that option. And then the other one was to come home early and have some episodes of dealing with all the aftermath. Too. So
yeah.
What were your thoughts? Like Chris said, what were your thoughts? But also, what was the was there really a debate internally, or was it pretty much decided it was always going to be this way?
I'm sure there was more of a, a debate. I'm sure it was more of a discussion between, you know, Ken and Brannon and Rick about what they were going to do. There was, now that you mentioned it, a talk of bringing them home unexpectedly early, and then just, which I thought was a terrific idea. But I think then you do possibly kind of run the risk of, well, then what is season 7 of the show? Is it now Next Gen? I mean, is the crew still together? Is the ship in a museum? I think people were really attracted to the sort of boldness of that notion. They're just home in the first episode, but I don't know what the rest of the season would have been. I don't think that notion went very far. But again, I wasn't really at that. I wasn't even working on the show at that point. I was 7 episodes in writing a freelance script. So I by the time I got there, those decisions had really already been made.
Okay. Anyway. Because the other end of that is, I remember just on the promotional side and what UPN was playing with, and the what they were trying to manipulate, they were trying to throw it out there a little bit and just tease people back in the day of whatever constituted media in 2001, 2000.
Yeah, I mean, remembering, I haven't seen the episode in years, but if I recall, Endgame opens with the ship getting home, and then they kind of backfill and, two Janeways and alternate reality and all of that. I pitched a story to Ken that my intention, it was just an interesting story, I thought, that could have been, had they not already worked out what Endgame was going to be, an alternate series finale, and it was a kind of a Janeway Chakotay love story, and I ended up taking that same idea.
You just made my relationship or heart so happy, because they toyed with that idea so much. They really just, I wish they would have resolved it somehow to either break it off, put an end to it, or to actually get them together toward the end of the series, because they had great chemistry. They could have pulled it off.
Sure. What if they got together, they got back to San Francisco, they went into Janeway's apartment, they opened the door, and right there on the bed, the monkey was sitting there.
Would have been fitting, wouldn't it?
From Resolutions.
Yes. Yeah. The monkey always keeps them apart.
Such a distraction. And why was she so interested in him anyway?
Well, what I was going to say is this idea that I ended up not selling that year. I ended up recycling as an episode of Enterprise. It became an episode called Twilight.
I was going to say.
Yeah. Yes, Twilight.
And so that the initial idea was that was going to be a Janeway Chakotay show, and where he was now taking care of her, and over the course of her illness, the ship gets home. And so she's sort of learning.
Oh my God, I didn't know this. How did I not know this? You're blowing my mind right now.
Clearly, you don't spend enough time on Memory Alpha.
No, I don't comb through every line of it. I do not.
But no, that was my pitch for that story, and I'd always loved it. And I always wanted to do something. There was something about, because it was also an homage in many ways to Memento, that wonderful Christopher Nolan film.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Which came out around that time, and I was like, I want to do a sci-fi Memento, and so I was like, oh, Chakotay, Janeway, and then that didn't work, and I hung on to that idea. And it ended up fitting even better, I thought, in many ways, as an Archer to Paul's story many years later. Because it also had the fate of the Earth, and then you do a teaser where the Earth blows up. I mean, you don't get a better teaser than that on any television show.
True.
But I would have loved to have seen that alternate reality Chakotay Janeway episode. I think it could have been really touching.
Yeah.
Well, I like the way you deftly jumped completely away from the Chakotay 7 of 9. You had nothing to do with that. No, I mean, you were so like, I had nothing to do with that. I had nothing to do with that. So,
Yeah, no, it just kind of came out of the blue, I think.
Yeah.
I would have rather have seen more of a, you know, a resolution to the Chakotay Janeway story.
So not one of your scripts, not one of your stories, but you were in the room at least 10, you were in the room more than any of us were. Even me coming in at the end and trying to
way more than me, Larry. Mike was way there more way than more you, than
right.
me.
So where did that, who was that, Ken's thing? Was everybody sitting around going, gee, we need to have an arc for everybody the last year here and go out with a bang? What can we do with Chakotay? Oh, let's, I mean, do you remember?
Well, you know, I mean, you're always having that conversation about, you know, all of your characters.
Like, right,
what, you know, what are we doing with, you know, pick your, you know, what are we doing with Neelix this year, this season? You know, Neelix, for instance, we didn't want him to get to Earth. So then the episode was, it was Homestead.
Right.
Evolved out of literally, let's say goodbye to Neelix. Let's give him a proper farewell because Earth is not his home. And so, you know, that was something that started, you know, the seeds of that were being planted earlier in the year. So yeah, I can't really, I'm sure I was part of some of those Chakotay conversations. I can't really recall them, quite frankly.
You're going to make me dig out my tape. Okay, fine.
Tapes. Wasn't it a dare from Robert Beltran to Brandon Braga to give him a romance with 7 of 9?
That story sounds as plausible as anything.
That's what Robert Beltran said at Star Trek Las Vegas, among other places.
Well, there you go. That's from the horse's mouth.
Well, we've been going well over an hour. So do you guys have any last questions for Mike about season 7?
I could do this all freaking night, but I know we don't have the time. I think I'm good.
Just real quickly, you were talking about how when Brandon and Rick were developing Enterprise as season 7 went along, they until they hired you, which after your last show was done, so after Renaissance Man, late in the one before the two-part finale, and they deigned to share the pilot script with you and say, hey, you're on staff, yay. Do you remember before that, and you actually saw it physically, just as the year went along in break sessions or anything would come up and somebody would say, even Brandon from afar or Rick from notes or whatever would steer you away from something because it might overlap something they were thinking about doing. Even though we're talking about different time periods and a prequel and all that, did you remember Enterprise's development affecting any of the choices being done on
I mean, yeah, but not really that I can recall. I do remember there was one, I can't remember what Voyager episode it was. There was a character who is going to be like an expert translator. But I can't remember which episode it was.
I think you tell this story on or somebody tells this story on the writer's reunion of Enterprise, which is kind of funny. Or somebody talks about, yeah.
Yeah, which I was at. I would think I would remember that. There was a character who had some super translating ability. And I think at the time they were still developing the character of Hoshi, who, you know, if you remember, had an ear for languages and was a bit of a prodigy. And I think the thought was, you know, the idea was, oh, this character might be too close to the Hoshi character, who none of us on Voyager knew anything about yet. So we were asked to change that. I think it was an alien that had some translating ability. But again, I can't even remember what episode that was, or if this entire story is apocryphal, quite frankly.
And it turns out that alien was a Hoshian as well.
Exactly, right.
Hoshian, yeah. Well, you're telling the apocryphal story very
Yeah.
Or you're communicating the apocryphal story very well. Yeah. So it wasn't quite like TNG into DS9, the Voyager, you know, all those shows overlap, but they're all in the same time period. So there were things trying to mutually, like trying to set up the Maquis with the
right.
overlaps and
yeah,
all that
there,
stuff.
There wasn't really.
You really didn't have much of that, that's what I'm
yeah.
saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Not really. Not really. I mean, they were trying to. Enterprise was in many ways, obviously, it was not only a prequel, but they wanted it to be a very different show, a very clean break. From the 24th century. So, yeah, there wasn't really anything certainly in terms of instruction, like setting up Enterprise or anything like that, the way that DS9 and Voyager were certainly set up by Next Gen.
Well, Mike, to bookend this, my last question here for you, because we opened up talking about how you were a fan growing up and you got into writing for Star Trek. And, you know, when we're doing these things, I'm also a media person. I do magazines and, of course, I do podcasting, everything. And so I know it's always a race, you know, day to day, it's work. And you can't look back and reflect all the time. But now that Star Trek's all finished, when you look back at all the time that you spent working on Voyager and working on Enterprise, what does that mean to you as a fan that you got to do that?
Well, I hope Star Trek isn't all finished.
Yeah, yeah. But those series thought. Are over. So when you look back at that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine I'm certainly finished with Star Trek. It was a dream come true. It was a dream come true. You know, I was weaned on that original show, and the idea that it would ever, you know, come back in a form that I would someday have a. You know, have a say in terms of shaping it and writing for those characters or still, I look back on some of these old scripts where I got to write, you know, exterior space Enterprise or exterior space Voyager or Captain's Log, Stardate. I mean, I even now I get chills thinking that I got to put words in the mouths of these characters and be a small part of that. And what's so wonderful about it, Star Trek is a big family. And, you know, even now, years later, just having been a tiny part of some of the spinoff shows, I still feel like I'm a part of that family. And I'm greeted by other family members or people who are just fans of the entire franchise. As, oh, you are one of the creators of it. And mm-hmm. I'm not. I wrote a couple stories and was lucky enough to work there for a while.
No.
But, you know, I to me, that was what I aspired to. So it was a dream come true. And, you know, I've created a show since, which was a great experience. But nothing really compares to Star Trek. So honestly, I can't wait till it's back. On television, where it belongs. Not that I don't love the feature films, but I really do think it's a format for TV, and I can't wait to I can't wait for its return. I wait along with all of you.
We definitely are.
Yeah, we're ready.
Well, Mike, thanks for all your time today talking about Voyager. And what else do you have going on right now? Anything you want to tell people about?
Oh, well, I'm working right now on a really wonderful show on the Sci-Fi Channel called 12 Monkeys, which
nice.
Is, you know, inspired by the movie, which perhaps you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. We're about halfway through shooting season two right now, and it'll be on early next year on Sci-Fi Channel. And if you haven't seen season one, I'd ask your you know, listeners to check it out. I think it's on Hulu and iTunes, but it's a really good show. And one of, the co-creator of the show, Terry Metalis,
I was going to say,
worked on Star Trek for many years, was an associate on the show, was Brannon Braga's assistant for quite a while, and learned quite a bit at Brannon's elbow. But no, I'm thrilled to be reunited with one of my Trek colleagues and making what we hope is some terrific science fiction. So please check it out if you haven't.
Sounds very cool. And what if people want to find you? Where can they find you, in social media or your website or whatever?
Oh, I'm on Twitter, on the Twitters, I can't even remember what my handle is. I think it's my name. I think if you search for my name in Twitter, it'll probably come right up. Yeah. But I need to do more social media stuff. I'm a little negligent in that regard. But please follow me.
Well, you know, that also shows that you're actually doing something besides sitting around all day on social media, so...
Right.
Yes.
Exactly. Yes. Like, yay, I got 3 more followers. I'm very excited. Well, you know, I had on Perception, LeVar Burton, who, you know, Ken and I both know, obviously from Next Gen, was a recurring character on the show. And LeVar has probably like 2 million followers now. And he mentioned me a couple of times on Twitter, and I thought, I'm going to get so many. I think I got 3 followers when he mentioned me. So I don't know what the rest of his 2 million followers were doing at the time, but LeVar's terrific.
All right. Well, everyone, go check out Mike's stuff. Go check out the show as well, 12 Monkeys. And Mike, hope you'll come and join us again sometime.
I'd like that a lot. This was a lot of fun.
And I'll stop teasing you. We'll have lunch here in the next month or so.
Sounds good. You're paying,
so
Larry.
He says.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that 12 Monkeys hadn't been picked up after its second season. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, guys.
Hey, good night.
Well, Larry, that was great having Mike on to talk about this. You know, the fact that you guys have talked in the past and you've interviewed him before is interesting because you have a lot of shared stories and things to talk about. And then I think for Char and me, it was just great to be able to pick his brain a little bit about what it was like working on season 7 right there in the moment.
Oh, yeah. No, I like I said, it took me back to the feature that we did the first time we interviewed him for Communicator. And I don't know, maybe we'll have something to do with some of those photos he sent. They're not going to die with issue 149. I'd like to see them live again. Maybe we can do something about that.
Maybe so. All right. Well, if you'd like to share your feedback on today's show, there are many ways for you to do that. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Voyager Season 7 and what Mike talked about. You can find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFilm. That's also our brand page on Facebook. And you can go to trek.fm/contact and use the form that you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the ready room. That'll come to me by email. And if you'd like to send us a voicemail, I'd love to hear that. And you can do that by going to speakpipe.com/trekfm and just use the mic on your tablet, phone, or computer, and you can upload it there from the page. Now, if you'd like to get into a bigger discussion, we would love for you to visit our listeners group on Facebook. That's called the Babel Conference. And the Babel Conference is a place where our listeners get together, and it's a closed group, so you do need to click join, and we'll let you right in. But because it's a closed group, and we only mention it here on the air on the shows, it's not one of those Facebook groups where, you know, every Star Trek fan wanders in because here's another Star Trek group. It's actually people who listen to the network. And so the conversations are generally an extension of the show. They're very respectful. They approach Star Trek the way that we do here on all of our podcasts. And that's one thing that I love about it. I'm in there. Larry's in there quite often. Almost all the hosts are in there. Everyone who's on Facebook is in there. And we've got close to 800 people all together. So drop by, join the conversation there. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it'll come right up. Click join, and we'll let you right on in there. Now, Larry, we talked in news about Portal 47, LarryNemechek.com/Portal47. But if people want to find you in other places and find out what's going on, where should they go?
Yeah, LarryNemechek.com is the hub for, you know, Con of Wrath, my documentary, and the on-speaker CDs and my calendar. Excited to be up at Salt Lake Comic Con here late in September. And we've got the whole 50th anniversary year beckoning to us and a lot of things happening there, including... 50th anniversary tour, I think I mentioned, with Terrace coming up with Geek Nation Tours next year. And on Twitter, I'm probably on Twitter more than anything else these days, more than Facebook even, but that's just at Larry Nemechek. And then if you're a Facebooker, my Trek home is Larry Nemechek's Trekland. Oh, and then the Trekland trunk. We're still pulling oddball things out for the trunk. And I think you're going to mention Enterprise in Space, but I still evangelize for that nonprofit. So, okay. So the website and at Larry Nemechek Twitter is good these days.
Yeah. We mentioned Enterprise in Space up at the front of the show in the bumper there. And that project, I understand, is moving along pretty well. You can check out enterpriseinspace.org and find out how you can support the project, help get these science experiments up into space on an orbiter, which will benefit students because they're going to be able to get their experiments on there free of charge. And it's a really cool project, so check that out as well. Great. Well, if you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook, and I have my website at cbrianjones.com. Elsewhere on the network, you can find me doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing, where we talk all things Deep Space Nine. I also occasionally do a news show called Hyper Channel. I produce the official podcast of Star Trek Axanar. And then you can also find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. And of course, Larry, you write for StarTrek.com as well. So you can find our thoughts on Star Trek there. And then beyond the world of Star Trek, you can find my non-Trek podcast, which is called Metropolis On Air. And that's tied into the magazine that I run here in Tokyo. I interview a lot of people on that show. We talk about many, many different topics, everything from Japanese culture to sports and entertainment and fashion and just all kinds of things. And we also have Japanese language tips and all sorts of stuff for you there on that show. So if for some reason you like listening to me talk and you want to hear me talk about something besides Star Trek, well, you can do that. Just go to iTunes and search for Metropolis On Air, or go to the website metropolisjapan.com. And if you don't see one of the podcasts on the front page, just type podcast in the search field and it'll come right up. And lastly, before we go, I would like to remind everyone again about all of our other shows on the network. If you're an Apple user, go to itunes.com/trekfm, or just search Trek FM in the iTunes app or the podcasts app. If you're not an Apple user, go to our website, stream from the page, grab the RSS link, find us in Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, Windows Phone, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, you're going to find us there. Check out all the other great shows that we have here on the network. And also, we can use your help in keeping the shows coming. We are a listener-supported network, so please go to patreon.com/trekfm if you enjoyed the show today and find out how you can help us cover our costs of production and distribution. It's very expensive to run this network. And also how you can participate and become part of the family. It's all there for you at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. All right, Larry, well, I'm going to let you go. I'm going to head down to the writer's room because I'm just dying to read Char's spec script that she wrote when she was 13.
You go ahead and do that, Chris. But, you know, as for me, I think it's time to stick a Delta Quadrant Batleth in it because the ready room is done.